announcements this morning. The first one is that today's designated collection is for the Hebron House of Hospitality. So during the offering, any loose cash or change that we collect will go to the Hebron House of Hospitality. And then the high school youth have an announcement, a special announcement.
Have you been searching for the perfect way to wow your significant other? Looking for a new highlight of the year? Do you love delicious Italian food? If you answered yes to any of these questions, then the annual Valentine's dinner is right for you. Not only is there great entertainment and fabulous cuisine, but it also supports the church youth group. The dinner will be held on Saturday, February 15th. The cost is $50 per couple, and the dinner runs from about 6:30 until around 9. If you're interested, you can purchase tickets in the social hall after the service. Remember, supplies are limited, so you'd better get your table while seats last.
Is there entertainment?
Yeah, there is entertainment, isn't there?
Spirit of life and hope, we turn our minds and hearts toward one another on this day. Awaken us again to the mysteries that humble us, the realities that orient us, the truths that judge and guide us, the beauty that informs and ravishes us, the love that nurtures us, the fellowship that sustains us. The creativity that heightens and deepens and reorders our living, that we may give ourselves in honesty and openness to the larger life before us. Come and let us worship here together. Would you please take a minute to say hello or to introduce yourself to the people around you this morning?
Thank you.
with humility and courage born of our history, we are called as Unitarian Universalists to build the beloved community where all souls are welcome as blessings and the human family lives whole and reconciled. With this vision and hope in our hearts and minds, we light our channels. Now, will you please stand as you're willing and able and join in our first hymn, number 95, There Is More Love Somewhere. Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Christy Ayler, and I am the worship associate for this morning's service. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to all of our visitors, friends, and members joining in. Please take a moment at this point in the service to loosen the bonds of your electronic tethers. That means turn them off. And welcome to everyone, and we're pleased that you've chosen to celebrate and worship with us today. There is a slight change in the order of service, which will become evident now.
one of the ways that we try to help out is by collecting for the local food pantries, both in our neighborhood and a little wider out, through the collection of non-perishable food items that we donate each month and financially. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward, ask a child to bring them forward. And I invite the children to stay up front and enjoy a story. And as you can tell, we're doing something a little different today, so please bear with us. Technology is scary. We think we've got this. You guys want to sit where you can see the screen?
Far below the ocean waves, a narwhal lay in bed. All night long, his narwhal dreams kept swimming in his head. He dreamt a dream of swimming up to see the sky above, lit up by the sun in colors he just knew he'd love. But narwhals never swam that high. Their fins were much too small. Their tails were thin and floppy, which didn't help at all. This narwhal liked his fins and had no problem with his tail. So when he woke, he knew that he just wouldn't fail. I'm swimming up above the waves to see the sky of blue. I've never seen it even once, and now it's time I do. The other narwhals warned him that he shouldn't swim so high, as did the blyfish family that always swam close by. No narwhals ever swum that high. It simply isn't done. A blyfish might just make the trip, but we know you're not one. Narwhals don't have flappers like all us blyfish do. You don't even have coggers like the swimming gungaloo. But the narwhal didn't listen, and he left his friends behind. No silly blyfish family could ever change his mind. He swam up past the boulders made of spongy gishy gosh, and flew right by the herd of floating, feeding thistlefish. His fins were getting tired, but he knew he couldn't stop, so he kept swimming faster, trying hard to reach the top. Just then a hungry warble blocked the narwhal with his fin. He grabbed him by his tail and brought him right up to his chin.
I've never had a narwhal. This would be a tasty treat, but you're much too thin and bony for a fish like me to eat.
So the narwhal just kept swimming and didn't dare to stop until he heard the sound of a great big bubble. He turned around to see that he was in a bit of trouble. The sound he heard was that of a silver subbubble. The narwhal tried to hide somewhere that he could safely stay, but the subbubble saw him and was headed right his way.
Oh, Mr. Subbubble, please don't eat me up for lunch. I'll bring a yummy plant instead for you to sit and munch.
I've never seen a narwhal try to swim this high before. What is it, little fishy, that you're up here looking for? If I could see the sky just once, I'd be a happy fish. To do one flip above the waves would be my only wish. Well, sorry, silly narwhal, but I cannot let you go. It's sub-a-level dinner time. You should have stayed below. The narwhal cowered back in fear and shook from fin to fin. But then he saw a school of fish called Shiny Glimmy Glen. The Glimmy Glen swam right past the sub-a-level's face, and the narwhal grabbed a glimmy fin and quickly left that place. The narwhal swam up higher still until he saw some light. He knew it had to be the sun, and oh, was it a sight. Closely by, a plank was sleeping, lying on his back. He rubbed his giant belly as he dreamed about a snack. The narwhal smiled happily and set his fins a-swimming. He didn't see the plank wake up, for he was busy grinning. The narwhal almost made it to the surface of the sea, but the plank chomped down and swallowed him as if he were a pea. The narwhal sat inside the plank and started softly crying. He'd never make it out. So was there any point in trying? The narwhal knew he'd come too close to quit and give up now. There must be some way out of here. There's got to be somehow. So the narwhal swam around inside, trying very hard to think. And while he did, his floppy tail was tickling the plank. The plank was very ticklish, and he couldn't hold it in. He tried to cover up his laugh with his giant plankish fin. His mouth was open long enough for the narwhal to swim free. He swam so fast the hungry plank did not have time to see. Far above the ocean floor, above the narwhal's homes, above the blyfish families and dancing water gnomes, above the swimming gungaloo and slimy gundledun, a narwhal flipped above the waves and smiled at the sun.
Went camping with a friend who happened to be a staunch no-nonsense atheist, and they set up camp and pitched their tent and eventually settled into sleep. But a few hours later, not really used to the wilderness, they both woke up. With her hands behind her head, the minister asked her friend, "I wonder what you think of when you look up and see the stars." "I think about planets and galaxies and natural beauty," the friend said, "but not about religious stuff, please." "But I'll bite. What are you thinking about when you look up at them? Faith? Hope? God?" "Not really," the minister said. "Actually, I was trying to figure out who stole our tent." "While our tent is still here all around us, it never hurts to be prepared. The morning offering will now be given and received."
Thank you.
is the time in our service where we share our joys and our concerns. We do this in two ways. We speak them aloud and we light candles. Would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
This is Chris. Someone had to go down to Arizona to check on Linda Campbell and Sue Andrews, so I did that last week and went to the Valley Unitarian Universalist Church with them and Mike and Terry Fritz, if you'll remember, former members that live down there too. So I'm reporting everybody is fine in Arizona.
Yes, this is Jim. If you would light a candle of great joy, this week I am celebrating 8 years clean and sober and 7 years as a member of this wonderful congregation.
I'm Howard Bowman. I would like to ask for a candle of thanksgiving for the life of my father, Everett Bowman, who died last month at 98.
Hi, I'm Tony. I'd also like to light a candle of joy for my dad, who was just buried yesterday, who was almost 98. Another long, happy life.
This is Robert. If you'd light a candle in memory of the many thousands of people who died in Haiti, it was 4 years ago last Sunday that they experienced a catastrophic earthquake.
I'd like to light a candle of concern for Lori Lobbin's mom, who passed away last week at 88.
If you could light a candle of concern for the mental health well-being of our youth. We lost a student at our high school this week. He took his own life, and I think we sometimes forget the dark monsters that live inside those young minds.
And we light our last candle today for all of those joys and all of those concerns which we hold deeply, but which have not been mentioned here.
The first reading today is Thoughts from the Town Beyond the Wall by Elie Wiesel. Elie Wiesel was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986 for speaking out against violence, repression, and racism. In his fourth novel, The Town Beyond the Wall, his main character, Michael, like Wiesel, a concentration camp survivor, opens himself once again to the risk of relationship. His experience in the camps has left him without family or friends and without any hope for meaning in human life. In an exchange of life stories with a Spaniard named Pedro, who has also experienced profound loss, Michael begins to understand his own past and feels the need to return to his hometown, even though this town is now behind the Iron Curtain, and Michael would be imprisoned if caught there. But more than that, Michael rediscovers the joy of friendship. Before they part, Pedro says to Michael, "From now on, you can say, I am Pedro. And I am Michael." They have become part of one another's lives and carried the hope of each other's survival. Michael does try to return to his hometown, and the worst does happen. He is imprisoned, tortured, left virtually alone. His cellmate is a young man, a stranger, so overwhelmed by his own suffering that he has sought escape from the world by completely withdrawing from it,
by retreating to some psychic space, seemingly oblivious to anyone or anything. Michael was once a stranger locked in his own suffering, and Pedro reached out to him. Michael decides to try to do the same for this young man. He tells the stranger that someday, you'll tell me your name, and you'll ask me, who are you? And I'll answer, I'm Pedro. And that will be a proof that man survives, that he passes himself along. Later, in another prison, someone will ask your name, and you'll say, I'm Michael. And then you will know the taste of the most genuine of victories. Instead of desiring the escape of mental withdrawal for himself, Michael reaches out in the hope of drawing this young man back into human life. We do not learn whether Michael succeeds, but we do know that he tries, that Michael, once a stranger himself, offers community to another stranger in turn. We do know that Michael has found his humanity again, and therein has found meaning and hope. Here ends the first reading.
Please join me now in a few moments of silent thought, meditation, or the spirit of prayer.
This song is about hope, although when I sing it by myself, it doesn't feel real hopeful, so I'm inviting you all to sing along in the choruses. I know some of you have heard this before. The words to the chorus are printed in the order of service, and so if you join me in the choruses, I'll sing the verses, and we'll catch on. This was written from a pretty dark place, and I'm happy to say I'm not there anymore, but I'd like to dedicate to anybody in the church who's in that kind of place right now. That too shall pass.
breaks the heart still open after the well runs dry. Here's the finding faith when you're out of reasons why. Here's the holding on when you want to let go. Here's the heart still open. Here's the heart's made whole. The news is mostly bad.
Second reading is called After the Hurricane, written by J. Trovato. Hurricane Katrina made landfall on August 29th of 2005. J. Trovato, a Texas resident, writes, "We were in financial distress ourselves, but we had a home, a vehicle, two outstanding teenage children, and through our extended family members, we're making it month to month. On Thursday, September 1st, we drove down to the Astrodome area with all that we could pack into our car in hopes of finding a place to donate items that would reach evacuees quickly. We found a group that had organized efforts to collect and disperse items in desperate need. We worked with this group for a few hours, helping to organize and unload others' donations. While we worked, many evacuees were walking the streets, just deposited here from buses from the Superdome in New Orleans. Most had no shoes, were filthy, thirsty, hungry, and homeless now. As we worked our way back to the buses, we parked and watched. Soon, a young girl of 20 carrying a 13-month-old baby and an elderly lady around 67 walked past our car toward the Astrodome. My husband got out of the car and approached them. I stayed inside because I had given my shoes to someone earlier. He asked these ladies if they needed help or if they had family here, and they both cautiously said no. He directed them to me, thinking that they may be mistrustful of him, and I too told them we were willing to help if we could. The elderly lady jumped in the back seat immediately. The young girl asked me if she could get some help. I said, "Of course, please get in." She did, and we brought her and her baby and the elderly lady home with us that night. We had no idea what we were going to do past this one night. Our goal was to give them a shower, a meal, and a place to sleep. We immediately saw their cautious relief, their careful hope. They never left. Miss Carrie, Bertukan, and Yosef are still with us today. We are learning a lot from one another and what it means to open your heart and your home to people in need. Here ends the second reading. Now please stand as you're willing and able and join in singing hymn 1012 in the teal hymnal, When I Am Frightened.
Thank you.
I hope I get a bike for my birthday. I hope Billy asks me to the dance. I hope the baby's a girl. Every day, all over the world, people are saying things that sound something like this. Merriam-Webster says that to hope is to cherish a desire with anticipation. And dictionary.com says it's the feeling that what is wanted can be had, or that events will just turn out for the best. I would say to you that if faith is that which you dare to believe can be true, hope goes right with it. Hope is the anticipation that it will be true. So let me repeat that. If faith is that which you dare to believe can be true, hope is the anticipation that it will be true. Hope and faith feed one another. They can't exist without one another, but where do we find hope? Bill Schultz, the past president of the UUA, and a lovely man who I had the great fortune to have teach several of my courses in seminary, asked a group of us seminarians that question a few years ago. And of course, being Bill, what he actually said was, if I were to go, as I have so many times, to sit with those who have been tortured, who have seen the worst humanity has to offer, what source of hope could I give to them? In a world filled with despair, tell me why I should get up tomorrow morning. Why should they get up tomorrow morning? And don't be idiotic in your answer. Now, you talk about perspective. You're a first-year seminarian sitting there hearing this, and that trite little answer you were about to give that copied word for word from the book you read last night, and you're about to give it to a man who has traveled the world with Amnesty International, with the UUA, who has stood with the victims of torture and held them as they cried, and you're going to give him a smart-aleck answer. Ooh, no. This was a real question, a question where that trite answer would do more harm than good. And to answer the question, we have to look first at how we learn to hope. A baby doesn't hope. When we're born, we don't hope. We have no concept of anticipation. Have you ever played peekaboo with a little bitty kid? When you or they cover their eyes, the world disappears. It is over. Their eyes are uncovered. And what sorcery is this? The planet has come back into existence. It's a miracle. They laugh and they clap and they want to do it over. And each time, it's the same miracle. But as the baby grows, the idea of desire, of want, starts to take root. And of course, a toddler's desire is about 9 seconds long, because that's as long as they can remember. They see mom or dad or older sibling with cookies. They want the cookies. They start to dance around with one hand out, anticipating the cookies they get every afternoon. They develop faith in the presence of cookies. And if their faith is rewarded long enough, eventually they begin to hope for more cookies, for better cookies, for cookies like the ones they saw on TV or at the store. They no longer just want something, no longer just dare to believe it will be there. They want something joyfully, with a real anticipation of getting it. If that child's hope of cookies is supported, if mom or dad or parent or guardian continues to buy cookies, and sometimes they're the really good ones, the child learns that hope is real, that it is reasonable and worthwhile. Simple lesson. But what happens when something goes wrong? When either the cookies stop before the child dares to believe that they will be there, and so there is no faith, or the child develops faith that there will be cookies, and then they stop. Hope fails. But in a world where cynicism seems to be everywhere, where bad things do exist and violence can be overwhelming, we can keep hope from failing. We can keep the metaphorical cookies coming. We affirm and promote seven principles: the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth, a free and reasonable search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of democratic process, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice, and respect for the interdependent web of all existence. For many of us, our own faith, what we dare to believe can be true in the world, arises from these principles. We ask ourselves questions about the nature of the ultimate, the nature of humanity, about life and death, right relations, community. And when we find what we believe, we not only believe it, we believe it because we feel that it can happen. This isn't just some pipe dream. We believe and we cherish our anticipation and hope for the realization of our vision of reality. Without faith, without that daring to believe that something can be true, there's no hope. They are intimately connected. And our faith, our hope, can bring hope to those who have none. One of my favorite stories of the creation of hope is the story of Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a U.S. civil rights activist who led the fight against segregation and other forms of racism as a minister in Birmingham, Alabama, and in Cincinnati, Ohio. And Reverend Shuttlesworth was one of the people who helped pave the way for MLK. He was the co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and was instrumental in the 1963 Birmingham campaign. He worked against racism and for alleviation of the problems of the homeless in Birmingham and in Cincinnati, Ohio, when he moved there in 1961. He helped Dr. King during the Civil Rights Movement and was given an acceptance award to visit him at any time during the movement. What did Reverend Shuttlesworth do? He brought hope that it would actually be possible to live in a better world. Hope of surviving, of thriving together. Hope not just on a distant God, but on one another. In May of 1956, Shuttlesworth and Ed Gardner established the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights to begin to take over where the NAACP formerly had worked. They were determined to fight through education and protest and litigation to end racism. And perhaps for the very first time, both black and white people believed it was real. It could be done. Knowing that on December 26th of 1956, the group would begin to challenge racism laws, someone decided that they would stop Reverend Shuttlesworth. They taped 16 sticks of dynamite under his window on the night of December 12th. The house blew up. People were already gathering to mourn when Reverend Shuttlesworth walked out of the rubble unharmed. Of course, he ran directly into the police officer who had been sent to see what happened, a member of the local Klan. He advised the Reverend, "If I were you, I'd just get out of town as quick as I could." Shuttlesworth told him to tell the Klan that he wasn't leaving, and that he hadn't been saved to learn to run. He held in his hands at that moment the hope of his community, not only faith that he could succeed, but true hope that the whole work would be successful. In 1957, Shuttlesworth, along with Dr. King and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, Reverend Joseph Lowry, Reverend T.J. Jameson from Baton Rouge, K.C. Steele from Tallahassee, Reverend A.L. Davis from New Orleans, Bayard Rustin and Ella Baker founded the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It adopted a motto to underscore its commitment to nonviolence: not one hair of one head of one person shall be harmed. He embraced that philosophy, even though his own personality was combative, headstrong, and blunt-spoken, to the point that he antagonized, well, pretty much everyone. He was not shy in talking to Dr. King, who he felt should take a more active role, and warned him that history would not look kindly on those who gave flowery speeches but did not act. Eventually, by devoting as much time to the civil rights movement as to his own church, he alienated his congregation. In 1961, Shuttlesworth moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, and to the Revelation Baptist Church. He returned to Birmingham over and over. He was personally fearless. When other activists were scared off or mystified by him, he said he had vowed to kill segregation or to allow it to kill him. For those who heard him speak, who saw him walk away from beating after beating, it was a revelation. Someone worked for them. Someone cared. Someone had faith in a world that could be different. And his faith, one man's faith, was often enough to create hope where it had never been before. And the beautiful thing about this hope, and any hope, is that it's self-reinforcing. Each day as we struggle to live by our values and principles, to call into being those things we dare to believe can be true, we are driven to hope. And as we hope, we work harder to make these hopes come true. Hope is not created by a divine agency or given to people as some specific gift. It is the work of human hands and human hearts, part of the silk which makes up the interdependent web. Like faith, it is active. It ebbs and flows. It can be given as a gift to one another. It underlies all that we attempt to achieve. It can falter and fail, but it can never be destroyed. On March 19, 2006, I was honored to be at the Greater New Light Baptist Church to hear Reverend Shuttlesworth preach his final sermon before he retired. I had met him many times before, always impressed by how quickly he could aggravate an entire room into doing something that he felt needed to be done. He was a little stooped and had to be helped onto the stage that day, but resplendent in a pale pink shirt and glowing pink pocket square. The applause went on forever, and men and women began to cry as the music began. After saying that, well, he never was as good at religion as he could be, he gave a sermon about the amazing use of the human mind. Quoting scripture liberally, he reminded his audience, "You can't just unscrew a human head and put a better idea in there. It don't work like that." He talked about becoming part of a great communal mind headed by Jesus and his understanding that would work toward betterment for all. He talked and talked about the call to go forward bravely, despite dynamite or brass knuckles or chains, living in hope that you had done right and would bring healing to the world. Self-reinforcing hope. And it didn't hurt that he reminded his flock several times that he was indeed, as he said, dynamite proof, here to show you. What an incredible man. My last story about hope is one that I have been intimately familiar with, and some of you may have similar stories. A little over 4 years ago, I'd made a decision to change my life, to follow my faith wherever it would lead me, and to go into ministry. I applied to seminary and was accepted, and I felt great. Took a job at a little tiny nursing home, working 2 16-hour shifts a week as a nurse, and I prepared to go to my first classes. For the first time in years, I had to buy pencils. But something weird was going on. I had lost 80 pounds over the previous year and was feeling a little strange. I attended the first convocation at seminary and began my reading list, but the strange feeling had gotten worse. One day as I was typing, I realized my fingers weren't hitting the right keys, and my entire page was gibberish. My vision started to fluctuate, and I realized that week at work that I couldn't see the pills or the markings on the needles. I tried to read my own charting as a nurse, and it was scribbles on the page. There were no words. I went home terrified, rejoicing that I had 5 days until I had to be back there, unsure of what was happening. A few days later, I went to a new local doctor and asked for lab tests, but it was too late. I woke up the next morning and I didn't know my middle name or my birthday or where I was. My arms and legs jerked and seized and my head rolled in circles. Voices told me I was going to die and that I should run away as we drove frantically for the hospital. At the ER, I managed to tell a nurse I was having some kind of psychotic episode for all I knew. And then I sat and started to cry. Tests revealed that my thyroid hormones had become toxic and my brain had swollen in response, a condition called Hashimoto's encephalopathy, also known as pseudo-Alzheimer's disorder. If we couldn't find a way to reduce the swelling and stop the thyroid, I would suffer from progressive dementia and would typically die within 36 months. I couldn't even understand what they were telling me. But a week later, I was introduced to my doctor, my endocrinologist, the man who would come to save my life. He sat with me in an appointment room for over an hour and a half as I tried to understand what he was telling me. And at last he said, "All right, here's your job. Stop worrying. Start hoping. I will get you through this." Well, I thought he was a big fat liar. I underwent medication, then radiation and burns, eventual thyroid removal. And when I woke up from the surgery, I had a shock. My laryngeal nerves had been partially severed, my left vocal cord paralyzed, my parathyroids removed. I could not speak, I could not process calcium, and I would have to be on multiple medications for the rest of my life. I couldn't breathe because my paralyzed vocal cord blocked my throat. After training as a vocalist from the time I was 9 years old, I was told I will never sing again. I wouldn't be capable of being a nurse for months or years. More than one person told me that perhaps ministry was no longer appropriate. But each time I met with Dr. Pretorius, he had a new trick, a new approach, something new to try. And my faith in him grew, and as it did, my hope. At my teaching church, my first year of seminary, I was unable to speak. I spent a year listening, reading, doing assignments in silence. first one surgery, then another to create a working possible vocal cord, 3 more surgeries to cope with the side effects of the medications. I lost part of my nose, part of the muscle in my upper left leg. The meds destroyed first my right red blood cells and then my hair. And I sat at church in chemo caps, writing things down so that people could understand what I thought. I did a pastoral residency at Good Sam Hospital. It took me over an hour to walk the 1/8 of a mile from my car to my floor. The muscles and tendons in my legs wouldn't work. More meds were needed. And Dr. Pretorius told me to shut up and keep hoping, because he hadn't lost faith. 27 months ago, I woke up after the 7th surgery and found that my left vocal cord was corrected. My voice had come back deep and rougher, but it was there. A few med changes later, and my hair began to grow. And then my brain stopped swelling, and the effects receded. Last January in Chicago, I sang in front of an audience for the first time since I had gotten ill. The swelling in my brain is gone. I can walk without pain. Bill Schultz asked a serious question that day. In a world filled with despair, tell me why I should get up tomorrow, why those who have suffered should get up tomorrow, and I have an answer. You should get up because human hands, powered by belief in a better world and working every day to be a source of hope, can create miracles for themselves and for the world. How do you give hope to the hopeless? As my doctor did, as Reverend Shuttlesworth did, you dare to believe in a world where your vision is the right one, where failure is not an option, and where hope will never end. Amen.
May we carry the light of hope and the warmth of this chalice as we go into the world. Our closing hymn is number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth. Please stand as you're willing and able and join in singing.
Oh,
into the world knowing that you must dare to dream. Imagine the world as it can be and allow your faith and hope to lead you forward day by day. Peace, and may it be so.